This hour's top stories: the European Union slams as deeply disappointing a decision by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to delay the first Palestinian elections in 15 years. India registers a record single day of over 386,000 new cases of the coronavirus and nearly 3,500 new deaths from the disease. Also ahead, the UN warns that nearly half of the population in Myanmar risk falling into poverty by 2022 due to the impacts of the coronavirus and the country's political crisis. Welcome to the program. The European Union has condemned a decision by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to postpone the first Palestinian elections in 15 years. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell called the decision deeply disappointing. He said a new date should be set without delay. Legislative and presidential elections were due to be held on May the 22nd and July the 31st, respectively. But on Friday, Palestinian President Abbas delayed them. He cited a lack of assurances by Israel that voting would take place in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Various Palestinian groups criticized the move. Resistance movement Hamas called the decision a coup against its partnership with Abbas's party, Fatah. Hamas has expected, or was expected, to do better than Fatah in the polls. Well, India has logged yet another record daily rise in its coronavirus cases as it faces severe shortages of medical supplies. The health ministry on Friday registered over 386,400 new cases in 24 hours. That takes India's total tally to more than 18 million, the second largest in the world. The country has been posting record after record in its daily COVID cases in the past few weeks. That has been blamed on large gatherings as well as people's reluctance to wear masks. The explosion in infections has caused a severe shortage in hospital beds and supplies of oxygen. A number of countries have pledged aid and assistance to India. The U.S. aid has just arrived there. We earlier spoke to our Delhi correspondent, Munawwar Zaman, about the coronavirus crisis in India. He told us how tragic the situation is as the country is grappling with an explosion in cases.
Well, the hospitals have broken down. They're overwhelmed. There is nothing they can do. They're trying their hard to save as much as life they can, and you wouldn't imagine. They have to make a choice whom to give the oxygen, whom to give the ventilator. I mean, they have to make a decision in seconds, depending on whose conditions is what. I mean, the situation is out of words. There is no word that can describe the situation. Till yesterday, we were talking about shortage of oxygen supplies and shortage of beds. Now, that's something which is not to be spoken about now. Now, the biggest trouble the country is facing is the lack of crematoriums, lack of food, lack of burial grounds. I mean, it is the biggest trouble now the country is facing, because people have to queue up to get their loved ones buried, to get their loved ones cremated, because there is no space left.
Grim situation indeed. Germany has reported more than 24,300 new cases from coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The figure declined by 400 compared with the daily case tally reported Thursday. Germany's total cases are now over 8 million, with nearly 83,000 deaths. On Thursday, Health Minister Jens Spahn said the number of infections seems to be heading lower, but he added the decline is not yet deep enough to suggest that the third wave of the pandemic has been broken. Germany's efforts to contain the third wave is complicated by the more contagious UK variant and a relative slow start to its vaccination campaign. Officials say few cases of the Indian variant have been detected as well. Meanwhile, Brazil registers more than 3,000 new COVID-19 fatalities as the country's overall death toll surpasses the grim milestone of 400,000. The U.S. is the only country where the coronavirus has claimed more lives. The Brazilian health ministry also recorded nearly 70,000 additional infections, raising total cases to more than 14.5 million. Health experts have warned the daily toll could remain high for several months as the Latin American nation struggles to secure enough vaccines while loosening restrictions. Elsewhere in the Americas region, Mexico has reported 529 new deaths from the virus, along with some new, well, actually more, 4,000 more confirmed cases, I should be saying. With the onslaught of the coronavirus pandemic last year, came an increase in hostility and racial abuse against Asians. And the Chinese community in Britain was no exception. As Saeed Pourreza reports, some of the abuse has been leveled against the very people putting their own lives on the line to save others.
The COVID-19 pandemic has led to a sharp rise in racism against Asians. Hate crimes against Chinese, East and Southeast Asians, and the horrific Atlanta shootings in the U.S. threw the topic into stark relief. In Britain, too, violence against Asians has become a bigger problem than it already was. According to one statistic, hate crimes against Asians in Britain increased fourfold in the first quarter of last year, a trend that continues to this day.
I was in my eye test appointment, and there was two spaces between me and every single people that came didn't choose to sit next to me.
I feel unsafe when I'm by myself, so I just like listen to the music. But, you know, some people are still going to say something when they see Asian people.
Before there were any lockdowns, the Chinese and other ethnic communities had already been suffering abuse as a result of fear and misunderstanding stoked by internet conspiracies. Then came former U.S. President Donald Trump pointing the finger of blame for the pandemic at China.
Many of the victims have started telling their stories on social media, where they're receiving increasing attention. Among them, a growing number of Asian healthcare workers, such as this nurse, racially abused by a patient whose very life he was helping save.
Racism does exist in our society. It's mirrored colonialism. Britain has been the largest colonial power, arguably, for the last 200 to 300 years, and an ideology that particularly came with the Victorians has risen to reflect that, one of European supremacy, and particularly British supremacy and white supremacy.
The thought of the UK being unsafe is a sentiment shared by British Asian healthcare workers. Some have thought of moving elsewhere, but have had to stay because of the pandemic-imposed restrictions on travel and immigration.
A disproportional number of them, drawn especially from overseas, who trained overseas, find themselves in subordinate positions within in the NHS. So despite their skill, despite their education, they're less likely to be in substantive consultant positions. They're more likely to be at staff grade, at sub-consultant level, career grade, to find it hard to progress. So there's like a glass ceiling.
The easing or lifting of lockdown measures should ordinarily come as exciting news for many. But for the Asian community in Britain, among them frontline healthcare professionals, the bitter experiences of the past year will continue to impact their lives for years to come. Saeed Pourreza, London.
To another one of our headline stories, the UN has warned about rising poverty in Myanmar in the wake of the country's political crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic. A report by the UN Development Program says poverty could affect up to 25 million people in Myanmar by 2022. That amounts to nearly half of the population there. The report says the number of people living under the poverty line has increased by 11% in the last year due to the pandemic. Now the rate could grow by a further 12% by early next year because of the political crisis. The turmoil began in February when Myanmar's military staged a coup and ousted civilian rulers. Moving on to another story, foreign forces have started their withdrawal from Afghanistan after some 20 years of presence in the West Asian nation. We discussed that matter with our guests in our news review program.
Now the North Atlantic Treaty Organization says it's begun withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan. NATO described the drawdown as an orderly, coordinated, and deliberate process. U.S.-backed military alliance said it plans to complete its pullout in a few months without specifying a date. Separately, the White House confirmed U.S. troops have begun leaving the country as well. President Joe Biden announced earlier this month that the U.S. will withdraw all of its forces from Afghan territory by the 11th of September, ending his country's longest military engagement. NATO has around 9,600 forces in Afghanistan, 2,500 of them American. Joining us now for the program is E. Michael Jones, editor at Culture Wars Online, or Culture Wars Magazine out of South Bend, Indiana, and Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joining us out of San Francisco, California. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there with you, Mr. E. Michael Jones. Your initial thoughts after 20 years plus, seems like this thing's about to really happen, isn't it?
Yes, it's been the longest war in the U.S. history. It's also over a crucial piece of territory, which was established by Rudyard Kipling. He called it the Great Game. He said anyone who controls the Hindu Kush controls the Eurasian landmass and the approaches to India. The withdrawal from that is a sign of the shrinking now of the American empire. The American empire just got too big. They can't maintain this anymore, and so the United States is pulling out. In a move that is reminiscent of the pullout of Vietnam, where you basically declare victory and then leave the people up to themselves to defend themselves.
Thank you, Mr. E. Michael Jones. And Scott Bennett, welcome to the program, bud. If you're safe and doing well out there in Northern Cali. Scott, your initial thoughts on this. And then when we saw NATO and the U.S. Give that presser last month that they're withdrawing troops and they've achieved their objective there, what was the objective? And was that just some kind of a theater? Or was the U.S. and NATO objective really achieved on Afghan soil?
I think they were recognizing that the objective, which was started under George Bush and Dick Cheney, which was based upon a fraudulent false flag attack of the 9/11 situation that was blamed on the former CIA agent Tim Osmond, also known as Osama bin Laden, and then conveniently transferring that guilt over to the nation of Afghanistan, the Taliban, and then launching this reckless invasion based on fraud and deceit of the American people of the world, that is finally coming to an end because of the natural deterioration of any effort built on lies. The entire event was built on lies. The entire campaign was built on lies. And it was also accompanied with a music of incompetence and stupidity because they failed to cultivate a soft war, an information war, a psychological war, or campaign, or persuasion operation, whatever you want to call it. They failed constantly, consistently, and inevitably because of the knuckle-dragging stupidity behind the military, State Department, CIA information operations to persuade the Afghan people to enter into some semblance of modernity that is not defined by the U.S., but is defined by a community of nations. So the U.S., by its arrogance and recklessness, has really run out of gas in the entire Afghan theater. It has generated enormous hostility, and now it realizes it's not ever going anywhere. We've run our entire gamut. No one likes us in that country. And the reason that the government and the military are desperate to keep the United States is because of the civil war that is brewing. Now, how that may be contained is another matter, but it has to be done through joint operations, I think, with Russia, with Iran, with China, with neighbors, Pakistan, India, all of the ones that are around that area need to try and cultivate a message operation so that the Taliban are not being self-perceived in violation of the religion, but at the same time, the Afghan government are able to stand up and protect its people from any sort of descent into authoritarianism or warlord rule or anything that resembles that sort of barbaric violence.
And Mr. E. Michael Jones, so after I mentioned 20 years plus, NATO and U.S. Forces, their Afghan project or their Afghan war, whatever you want to call it, let me know your interpretation of what they gained from it and what they lost throughout the time.
It was my understanding that Afghanistan was crucial to the heroin trade. We know that the CIA was involved in the heroin trade in the Golden Triangle in the after the Vietnam War because Jimmy Carter had cut off their funding. They needed an extra source of funding, and they started it there. Then when they lost that after the fall of Vietnam, they moved to Afghanistan. This is what everyone that I know is saying this. And the problem was that the Taliban stopped heroin opium production. My understanding was that's why the invasion took place. For every year that the United States was there, the heroin trade, opium trade, increased. So that had to be part of the operation. It seems to me there's no other explanation for what, plausible explanation for what was going on there.
All right, gentlemen, stay safe. Always a pleasure to have you both on. Mr. E. Michael Jones there joining us out of South Bend, and Scott Bennett there joining us from San Francisco, California. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. U.S. President Joe Biden has been interrupted by a group of protesters as he began a rally in Georgia. They called on him to close private detention centers.
I want to thank you, the people of Georgia.
End detention now! End detention now!
We'll give you a microphone.
No! End detention now!
Folks!
I agree with you.
Biden responded, I agree with you. Give me another 5 days. In January, the U.S. president signed an executive order that ended federal use of private prisons. Democrats hailed the move as an important step, but there have been calls for more action. Opponents of private detention centers say the facilities are linked with racial injustice. They also say the centers perpetuate mass imprisonment. And that's it with international news.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran Today.
JCPOA Vienna talks are into their third week, but as talks failed to conclude, parties agreed to forming a third expert working group to focus on steps to restore the nuclear deal or JCPOA. Perhaps three's the charm that will align Iran's expectations and America's intentions to achieve that goal. Iran sees three steps to reviving the deal, the first of which is sanction lifting by the U.S. But the U.S. categorizes sanctions into three sets, not all of which are meant to be lifted. So where does that leave the JCPOA or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action? Hanging. With hope. Dim as those hopes might be. But do they have to be? Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today to hear what some experts have to say. Far be it, hopes are misplaced in the third working group. It can't be an easy task to aim straight where delegations from each power party to the deal have failed to hit the target. That target being the revival of a deal the former U.S. administration officially binned in 2018. Mr. Kanani Moghaddam is one to ask for a realistic look at the present, which tends to make for viable predictions of the future.
The process of talks looks like a seesaw. I feel like the P5 plus 1 is putting its weight on the one side, so we have to give concessions to strike a balance. In game theory, there is a concept called balance, the win-win game. We haven't had a winning point yet. This means when a decision is made, no one should regret it. If not, we haven't followed the rules of the game. We are not at a point with the Americans, which if a decision is made, both sides will feel they have won. If this happens, commitments will remain in place. Otherwise, it may be us walking away this time.
Iran's three steps to revival are first, that sanctions be lifted off this country by the U.S. Second, that Iran verifies that sanctions have indeed been lifted. And third, that remedial nuclear steps be reversed by Iran. But then, the first step itself is a hurdle, looking at the U.S.'s categorization of sanctions. It describes them as 1. Sanctions it must remove to resume compliance. 2. Those it does not need to remove and would not remove. And 3. A category of difficult cases where the answer is uncertain.
Mr. Trump has imposed several additional sanctions related to the JCPOA, which are currently being discussed. Since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, there have been some sanctions against Iran, such as human rights sanctions or those regarding regional and arms issue. These have to be discussed under a separate framework. But the clever trick Americans use is that they tie everything together. Our central bank, for example, has been sanctioned 3 or 4 times over. Suppose the U.S. lifts the central bank sanctions, but the other sanctions remain untouched.
To give you a quick glimpse of who's who and in charge of what with regard to what's passed, Iran's verification of sanction lifting will have to be carried out by its central bank, petroleum ministry, and transport ministry. If it comes to that, verification will take at least 3 months because Iran will have to first get its crude oil flowing back into the global markets to the same amounts as under the 2015 nuclear deal. Only then can it be sure sanctions have worked. Mr. Qadiri Abiyane was Iranian ambassador to Mexico. He now directed his trip to Press TV studios to share his thoughts with us. Let's hear him out.
Americans say negotiations are successful when they are backed up by something. What can back them up? Military sanctions, the terrorist operations we have recently witnessed, and economic pressure. Diplomacy without something to back it up doesn't make sense. Mr. Zarif participated in the UN Resolution 598 in the 1980s, when we were in a war with Iraq. Negotiations wouldn't go anywhere if we had not liberated lands and taken several prisoners. We cannot allow Daesh to infiltrate Iran with the support of the West and repeat the atrocities it committed in Syria and Iraq. Diplomacy must serve the interests and security of Iran.
So far, what Press TV has learned is that the U.S. has only agreed to a short one-week verification period in which several transactions are symbolically performed, and that anyway the U.S. intends to lift some sanctions temporarily over a long period of time. Basically, the U.S. is considering lifting only JCPOA-incorporated sanctions, whereas punitive measures against Iran, which were imposed after the 2015 JCPOA signing, also cast a shadow on the spirit of the deal.
The Americans don't want the problem to be solved. My example is the game of snakes and ladders. We have been negotiating for 18 years. We climb the ladder only to get to a certain point and go back to square one. This must not happen. This is why the leader of the Islamic Revolution said the negotiations are not carried out for the sake of negotiations. The negotiations should not become exhaustive. The sanctions must be lifted, and that verification must be done.
As for today's working groups, the first two expert working groups in Vienna were tasked with drafting a comprehensive list of the sanctions the U.S. would need to lift and the nuclear steps Iran would have to reverse out of. It's the JCPOA Joint Commission that decides on working groups, just as it is responsible for overseeing implementation of the JCPOA. You must wonder how our experts of the day weigh the Vienna talks and whether they presume a timeline for a possible successful conclusion of talks. Mr. Beheshtipur, an honest pundit, was once the news bureau manager here at Press TV. He now joins us on Skype.
In my opinion, the conditions set by Iran are unattainable during the negotiations. Because Iran has said that all sanctions should be lifted and then they should be verified. You know that there are over 1,500 sanctions against Iran. It's virtually impossible to remove all of them in the process of the underway negotiations. Why is that? Because the American side is using the sanctions as leverage against Iran. If the United States lifts all sanctions, it will have virtually lost that leverage.
I have already said it before regarding the JCPOA. I believe that we will enter into an agreement with the Americans and the P5+1 and sign a text about it. But that text will not be implemented as many obstacles are blocking it. Some sanctions may be lifted, but nothing will change.
Iran is cool with returning with no results, as the U.S. is killing time by mulling what it can and can't do to push things forth. But regardless of Iran's 18th June elections, any action, if intended, best be taken soon. European officials are aware of that, given they said they hope to have something concrete in hand by mid-May, before a monitoring agreement between Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog expires later that month. Not to forget, the quicker the effort, the less room for sabotage of talks and results by outside elements. Israel, for one, has vowed not to let Iran's peaceful nuclear program advance. And now even the UN nuclear watchdog is all of a sudden referring to uranium traces in unexpected parts of Iran. This is while the watchdog had verified 15 times that Iran has been in full compliance with the nuclear deal.
They were able to carry explosives into a heavily guarded nuclear facility and detonate them. Can't they take the radioactive material elsewhere, contaminate it, and then say it is contaminated? If they could bring explosive inside, there won't be a problem for them to bring radioactive material inside. The same agents who were able to infiltrate could send the uranium residue elsewhere and then say it is contaminated here. That's their goal. Even a female inspector of the IAEA was found with nuclear material on her when she was entering the Natanz nuclear facility. They refused to let her in. I think she should have been arrested and tried.
Just a quick reminder, the very purpose of the deal was to limit Iran's nuclear program in return for nuclear-related economic UN sanctions to be lifted off this country in order to help Iran's foreign trade and economy. Other parties to the deal would, of course, have to invest in this by, say, buying oil from this country. Iran complied, but Trump's USA, ever unsatisfied, unilaterally pulled out of the deal on 8 May 2018. On the anniversary of that day, Iran started reversibly inching out of its commitments and is now enriching uranium up to 60% purity. That's up from 3.67%. Iran is happy to return to full commitment within the letter of the JCPOA if the US does so. And if other Western parties rise from their sleeping partner status. Parties were Iran on one side and the P5 plus one on the other. With the US pullout, we were left with P4 plus one. That's the UK, France, Russia, China, plus Germany.
The Europeans are serious about returning to the JCPOA. To them, the accord is a non-proliferation agreement and very important. But the reality is that there is nothing they can do about American financial hegemony. In practice, we saw that in May 2018, the United States unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA and virtually told everyone that you are either dealing with me or with the other side. Nearly all Chinese and Russian companies left Iran altogether. Europeans too. In other words, the Europeans did not and do not have the power to oppose US sanctions. So now, what the Europeans can do is act as a mediator.
It's back to the present, but with a quick look at other media outlets first. Always worth hearing what others have to say on one's matters of concern. And here are the words their thoughts were put into. Beginning with Deutsche Welle, Iran nuclear deal, signs of progress, but doubts linger. Despite the chasm between the two nations, the U.S. official did hint at the next step towards possible sanctions relief for Iran. The U.S. are not officially represented at the talks in the Austrian capital, but Washington can make its presence felt by intermediaries. As a result, the official said the U.S. had highlighted 3 points over the sanctions it is currently imposing on the Islamic Republic. Sanctions the White House is prepared to lift, those it is not, and sanctions that still require further examination. The official did not specify which sanctions fall into which category, but said the third group is the most problematic. It's because it includes measures that current officials believe may have been imposed by the previous administration simply to make any possible Iran return more difficult. An alleviation of sanctions will almost certainly be opposed by Israel, which regards Iran as a threat, as well as Persian Gulf Arab states wary of Tehran over similar fears. A local daily, Tehran Times, has it. Iran rejects gradual revival of JCPOA as EU mulls sequential return. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stated that Iran has a definite nuclear policy that will guide Iranian negotiators. The country's policy on the interaction with the JCPOA sides and on the nuclear deal itself has already been explicitly declared. This policy will not be violated in any way. It is a policy which has already been announced and which is adopted with everyone's agreement. It is not the case that this policy was an exception to other policies. Everyone has agreed to it, the leader said in a televised speech on March 21st. This policy is that the Americans should lift all sanctions. After that, we will verify. If the sanctions have been lifted, we will return to our JCPOA commitments. We will return without any problem. This is a definite policy. We do not consider American promises to be valid. If they say they will lift them on paper, this is of no use. What is necessary is action. They should lift the sanctions in practice. Subsequently, we will verify their statements to make sure the sanctions have been lifted. Then we will resume our commitments, he continued. We've got a piece by Sputnik News. Iran says Vienna JCPOA talks on right track will return to compliance once sanctions are lifted. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh has shared information on the ongoing talks by the Joint Committee of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in Vienna, saying that the negotiations are currently dealing with the technical details of the U.S. return to compliance and lifting sanctions against Tehran. He also noted that although some progress has been made, not all disputes have yet been resolved between the parties. We are at a difficult and complicated stage, but based on the leaders' stances, we seek to ensure the interests of the people and think that the talks are on the right track, Khatibzadeh said. The spokesperson added that the negotiations in Vienna would go smoother if Washington abandoned Trump's failed legacy and just agreed to fulfill its commitments under the JCPOA. And that would be it for the news segment. Back to our narrative. Regarding what matters, China and Russia, Iran's fellow Eastern parties to the deal, have spoken in favor of Iran's stance. That is for an uncomplicated revival of the deal by simply following JCPOA terms to the letter. Wang Kun, the Chinese envoy to the United Nations and other international organizations in Vienna, said, "Complete lifting of all relevant sanctions, including those on Iran and third parties, is the key to the success of the current negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal."
The United States has been adding to the list of countries under sanctions: China, Russia, Venezuela, and others. China and Russia also voted against Iran in the resolutions passed by the UN Security Council, but they are now under sanctions themselves. The more of these sanctioned countries are there, the more they cooperate, to the dismay of the United States. US sanctions have made many countries try to get rid of the dollar, a move which is very dangerous for the United States. The share of the dollar in the foreign exchange reserves of countries has fallen sharply and will fall even lower.
Mr. Kanani Moghaddam is not impressed by words paired with inaction.
We cannot accept America's promises. Other signatories must guarantee it. What's their purpose in their talks, after all, other than monitoring and guaranteeing the agreement? Russia and China seem to be sitting aside while the Europeans and Americans are cooperating. We're left alone. It shouldn't be like that. We mustn't be forced to agree to anything the Americans say.
On the other hand, Russia's representative to international organizations in Vienna, Mikhail Ulyanov, tweeted that there is no realistic alternative to the JCPOA. He wrote, "Why do almost all countries support restoration of the JCPOA? Because it is a key element of the international non-proliferation architecture. The deal, if restored, can provide credible assurances of peaceful character of the Iranian nuclear program via intrusive IAEA verification."
Both Iran and the United States wanted the talks to begin because the Iranian side had suffered billions of dollars in losses of the Iranian people's money because of the continuing oppressive sanctions imposed on it. It seems that there was no solution other than negotiations to solve this problem. At the same time, they claimed their consent about Iran's nuclear advancements. That's why I believe both sides needed the negotiations to take place.
As each side to the deal has come with fixations of its own, each seems to assess the outcome quite differently from the next. The critical question Iran faces is not, is the U.S. serious about re-entering the deal? Rather, it is, what would be the U.S.'s intention for re-entering?
If the U.S. really wants to return to the JCPOA, why would that be?
The ultimate goal of the United States is to overthrow the Islamic Republic, disintegrate Iran, and seize its oil resources. That's because the U.S. is concerned about losing its position as the single superpower. The world is becoming multipolar. China, India, Japan, Russia, and others are getting stronger, and the Islamic world is uniting.
While talks may have appeared to have progressed, a senior U.S. State Department official implied a day later that talks were likely to require several rounds, saying, "There still are disagreements, and in some cases, pretty important ones. We are not near the conclusion of these negotiations. The outcome is still uncertain. We have made some progress."
Thing is, Iran has said it will no longer linger and accept unwritten promises. All parties are seeking guarantees the U.S. won't just pull out of the JCPOA again at will. But the U.S. sees no feasibility in a guarantee that the next administration might pull out of. But then, what of guarantees the present U.S. administration will act reliably? This is necessary given even the Obama administration imposed sanctions after the 2015 JCPOA signing, and also given present Republicans in Congress, U.S. Congress, have recently, days ago, unveiled on Wednesday, the 21st of April, the largest ever package of Iran sanctions ever in history, as they put it. The bill, which has been dubbed the Maximum Pressure Act, would formally codify the Trump administration's tough sanctions campaign on Iran and would force the Biden administration to submit any revamped nuclear deal with Iran to Congress for review before it is approved. However, Iran will not accept a revamped deal.
The President of the United States has a lot of power. He could suspend congressional resolutions. That is, he does not have the power to repeal congressional resolutions. So, he can't cancel the Congress's laws against Iran, even if he wants to, which he doesn't. But it can use its power to suspend Iran's sanctions, as the Obama administration did, which was repeated on three occasions during the Trump administration.
The Wall Street Journal cited two people familiar with the matter as saying Washington was open to easing terrorism sanctions against Iran's central bank, its national oil and tanker companies and key sectors, including steel and aluminium.
I'm sure Biden will not lift the sanctions. If it wants to lift even the sanctions imposed by the JCPOA, it must return more than $100 billion to Iran. It will not do so. For this reason, I believe that the strategy of our foreign ministry is based on a kind of undue trust in the United States. America is not trustworthy at all. It wasn't under Obama and Trump, neither is it under Biden.
Analysts have said it is inevitable the United States would have to ease some of its terrorism-related sanctions if there is to be a revival of the deal, because without this, Iran would be unable to resume exporting oil. The newspaper cited one senior European official as saying that Washington has also signaled potential sanctions relief for sectors including textiles, autos, shipping and insurance. They don't all matter equally to Iran, however.
If our central bank is under sanctions, it can never finance nor trade, take its revenue from selling oil, or engage in domestic and international trade. It will be an absolute boycott. The central bank may be under several sanctions, JCPOA-related, American, European, human rights-related ones, and those under 20 to 31. If the U.S. lifts one, the other three remain in place. So we need to write out our demands and establish a framework, pass it through relevant authorities, and then submit that to the U.S. as a draft proposal.
Without lifting key sanctions that have hampered Iran's economic activities, any agreement would be indeed meaningless. JCPOA 2 and 3 are out of the question for Iran, but even the present JCPOA, the one and only, would mean nothing if, say, visa and ISA sanctions were not lifted. The anti-Iran sanctions imposed by former U.S. President Barack Obama's administration under the so-called Iran Sanctions Act, ISA, and the visa program will have to be terminated. So it's not just Trump-era sanctions the United States will have to fully remove, as Iran will not agree to a temporary lifting of the sanctions or their waiver.
It is expected that some of the important sanctions for Iran, namely those related to Tehran's oil sales, the central bank, and bans on Iran's sale of petrochemical material, will be either lifted or suspended in a very optimistic scenario, just as it was before May 2018.
There's been no direct or indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. It's other parties to the deal separately informing each of the two on one another's stance in Vienna. But so far, what we've got from a U.S. official is this statement. There are many other forms of sequencing that one could discuss, and we are open to that. But we are not going to accept a process in which the U.S. acts first and removes all the sanctions that it is committed to removing before Iran does anything. And although Russia's lead negotiator Ulyanov said on Monday, 19th of April, that a joint text is being drafted as representatives have moved from general words to agreeing on specific steps towards restoring the JCPOA, Iran doesn't appear inclined to budge from demanding all or nothing. All sanctions are to be scrapped in one stroke
and then Iran starts recommitting to the deal.
And that'll be all for today, but the best is yet to come as parties get closer to whatever the outcome of the talks. So do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Till then, bye.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, prevented the Muslims from practicing the following qualities. He, peace be upon him, said, "The owner of three traits will not die till he sees their evil results: oppression, cutting off ties of relations, and binding oath through which he fights with Allah. Indeed, the quickest obedience in reward is the relations with womb relatives. Perhaps some people are sinners. However, they visit each other. So their properties increase and they become rich. Binding oath and cutting off ties of relations leave houses empty of their people."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio.
We have found that in a very many conversations, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has urged his friends and his companions and the Muslims to treat people according to the Islamic rules of Islamic social conduct. It's interesting, but Imam al-Baqir at one point talks about a believer who has four qualities, in which results that Allah the Exalted will make them live in the rooms, on the rooms in the most high gardens of paradise. So Imam al-Baqir says to his companions after they asked him, what are these four qualities which will make a person live among the rooms of the beautiful rooms in the most high gardens of paradise? Imam al-Baqir said, it is one who shelters the orphan, has mercy on the orphan, and is like a father to the orphan. Also, it is one who has mercy on the weak, helps the weak, and suffices for the weak. These qualities, dear brothers and sisters, in this dialogue which we find, are qualities that on the societal level show the progressiveness, show the refinement, show the perfection, show the advancement of a society. When a society shelters orphans, has mercy on orphans, protects the orphans, supports the orphans, and is like a father to the orphans of the society, then that is truly an advanced and ultra postmodern society. And along these lines, a society who has mercy on the weak, helps the weak, suffices for the weak, the downtrodden, the oppressed, the disenfranchised, the hungry, the homeless of society, one who helps them, supports them, has mercy on them, suffices these people, is truly a postmodern society, an advanced society, both spiritually and materialistically. Allahu Akbar. This, dear friends, is dialogue Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Atar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
As a matter of fact, don't we begin our mahfil with the recitation of the Quran? Everywhere, regardless of a Sunni school or a Shia school, the recitation, the mahfil, the program begins with Quran. We have to reflect. Yes, we are beginning with the Quran. How did the Quran begin? The Quran started with Iqra. So when we are giving sort of respect to the Quran, is it just ritual that we just have to bring the mahfil with the Quran just because we do it all the time? Or is it really for us to really reflect Iqra, knowledge? How much are we really partaking in that? You know, it begins by Iqra, the Quran itself. And our mahfil, our programs begins with the Quran. So that means it's a mahfil, it is a event of knowledge. Because it has begin with the Quran. It begins with Iqra.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.